Are Canadians so smitten and lulled by their reputation as the world's good guys, polite, courteous, and progressive, that they're actually missing part of their own story? Today's guest believes that is the case. Joanna Chu is a senior journalist for the Toronto Star based out of Vancouver and says there's very little diversity in the leadership of Canadian newsrooms, with most decision makers being white men.
The Star tried to do in its hiring, at least on a reporter level, is to be as diverse as possible, not out of political correctness, because we recognize that Canada's diversity is not being reflected in our newsrooms, and there might be stories we're missing and perspectives we're missing.
Joanna kicked off her reporting career with a newspaper in Hong Kong before heading into mainland China and working for a couple of major publications from Beijing, where it was important to exercise caution.
When you're a foreign correspondent writing about human rights, you just try to be as law-abiding as possible. And when I go on reporting trips, maybe to interview people like underground church pastors or activists or people under house arrest, I always told my editors where I was going. Often we tried to go in pairs.
Now back in Canada and working for the Toronto Star, Joanna believes Canadians are starting to smell the coffee on diversity, racist, and xenophobic issues right here at home.
We've seen the rise of some more racist groups and some politicians on different sides of the spectrum actually pandering to some of these harmful stereotypes. So I think it's slowly people are waking up that xenophobia, racism, even white supremacists are real forces in Canada.
On this episode of Run It Like a Girl, Joanna talks more about her career, including an article she wrote last year that resulted in the firing of Canada's ambassador to China over comments on the Meng Wanzhou case. Joanna Chu on this episode of Run It Like a Girl. It should be noted that when this interview was conducted, Joanna was the Vancouver bureau chief for the Toronto Star. Shortly after the taping, the newspaper reorganized, dropping the bureau chief structure for its regional newsrooms.
Today I'm in my home office, where I'm really excited about having the opportunity to talk with Joanna Chu, who is the bureau chief and senior reporter for the Toronto Star Vancouver office. Joanna, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us for an episode of Run It Like a Girl.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on to talk about these things that I care about so much.
I'm very excited to have you, and maybe we'll just start. I'm very interested. So obviously you're a senior reporter and a journalist. You've had a pretty remarkable career thus far. I'd like to talk about, kind of go back a little bit, and why did you decide to become a journalist?
I wouldn't say remarkable, because every journalist I know seems to be superheroes who just get so much work done every day. But definitely, it is kind of like always an achievement when you make it in journalism, in having a job, because it's such a tough industry. And what I did was I went to do a master's in journalism, and then I went overseas, actually, partly because that was my personal passion and interest in Asia and China, but partly because it was a really, really tough job market for young people fresh from graduate school. Overseas, there were more opportunities because there's just less people.
So you were 23 when you went over to China as a foreign correspondent, pretty fresh out of school. I'd love to hear about what it was like during that first year there, and then also the major changes that you witnessed over your time reporting in China.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just did my master's in New York. I grew up in Vancouver, went to school here in Vancouver. The New York Columbia master's program had a connection with the South China Morning Post newspaper in Hong Kong. So I applied for an internship there, and I got it. And, you know, after my master's, after already doing internships, my first job was another internship. But that led to a full-time job at SENP in Hong Kong, which is Hong Kong's biggest English language newspaper. So actually, I started off my career in Asia in a local media outlet, and I think that was actually a good way to go about things. Often the field of foreign correspondence, you kind of look at different countries from an outsider kind of lens. But when you start off trying to report on things really closely on the ground, trying to be an insider, then I think that it enhanced and informed my foreign reporting role for international outlets better down the road.
Oh, that's very interesting. And how long were you away from Canada?
I think a total 8 years, over 8 years.
I'd love to know, what was your kind of, if you have any, I don't know if you can name your most memorable, but what experiences really stick with you from your time working over there?
Mm-hmm. It's tough to pinpoint because I didn't realize I was going in for such a dramatic time. So pretty much as soon as I arrived, Xi Jinping became president in China. And since then, human rights situation, civil rights situation, freedom of speech, everything had gotten, you know, started getting worse and worse. So I would be reporting on people disappearing, ending up in jails, like Hong Kong booksellers who you would think wouldn't be part of the mainland Chinese legal system, disappearing on vacation and showing up in Chinese jail and being kind of trotted out on live television, state TV, confessing to these crimes. So I ended up kind of being thrown into this kind of dystopian world where my family background is Hong Kong. So seeing that kind of rights and freedoms from Hong Kongers, which is a semi-independent part of China, kind of becoming, you know, becoming a question. And then seeing the protest movements in Hong Kong that we know that there's 4 months of really, really intense ongoing protests in Hong Kong right now, reflecting those anxieties and those news events that I was reporting on. So definitely I think what I reported on, starting from Hong Kong and then I later moved to Beijing, really stuck with me, and it's an ongoing story. Just this summer, even though after I moved back to Canada, I went back to Hong Kong to report on what's happening there.
I'd like to ask a bit of a follow-up question around that, because I'm interested in kind of your safety as well, and how what kind of protections there were for you to make sure that you could get the stories out that you wanted to tell. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I ended up, because being almost focused on human rights and politics and basically the most sensitive stuff that I could have focused on, because I felt that was the most striking thing I was observing around me. So I wanted to not just report in southern China, out of Hong Kong, I wanted to have a broader kind of geographical reach. So in 2014, I moved to Beijing to work for first a German news agency and then AFP, a French news agency, quite a big one, so reaching lots of people. And in Beijing, it's completely different in that you're actually in mainland China, where often mainland law applies. So you have to be really careful that you don't give a reason for yourself to get into trouble. So you try to make sure that you understand the different regulations. People don't know that every time you move apartments, you need to go to the police station to register, for example. But when you're a foreign correspondent writing about human rights, you just try to be as law-abiding as possible. And when I go on reporting trips, maybe to interview people like underground church pastors or activists or people under house arrest, I always told my editors where I was going. Often we tried to go in pairs. But it was an odd experience for me because even though I was a foreigner, a Canadian only with no type of Chinese or even Hong Kong passport, people treated me like I was a local Chinese person. That was good in some ways, in that I didn't kind of get the attention that some of my foreign colleagues instantly got, where sometimes they just couldn't even get on trains to go do reporting. I was able to move around pretty freely, but if I kind of came into some sort of roadblock or police were asking what I was doing, often they wouldn't accept that I'm a foreigner. So for me, that was kind of disarming because I know what the legal system is like for Chinese citizens. So in a way, being of Chinese descent in China, you kind of understand the type of risk that people are under.
Yes, I imagine so. And as a reporter and someone that's trying to get the stories out, what kind of censorship would there be? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you're working for foreign entities, so your stories are going out, but did censorship play a role at all?
Yeah, for sure. That was a big part of my kind of early years as a journalist. Like I said, I worked for a local Hong Kong newspaper, and the SCMP, unfortunately, kept going through a lot of self-censorship controversy. So I was there during that. Some of my pieces were, you know, self-censored. It was to do with the ownership, like a broader issue of the ownership of Hong Kong media, where it's often tycoons with lots of business interests in China. So it's self-censoring because they don't want to endanger their other business holdings. Right. Whereas when I was a foreign journalist in mainland China, actually I was able to report on anything I wanted. There was no self-censorship that I knew of or even heard of from other foreign outlets. I think foreign media in China was very careful not to self-censor. Even when the Chinese government would retaliate to reporting it didn't like by mostly exiling foreign journalists so they wouldn't renew their visas. One of my friends who was a journalist who reported a lot on a situation in Xinjiang with the internment and this heavy, heavy state surveillance and intimidation of Muslim Uyghurs, she went on vacation and then wasn't able to return to China. So all of her stuff was in Beijing, and she couldn't get back in because the government didn't like what she was writing about and revoked her visa, so she wasn't able to physically go back into the country. That's the main way they try to control foreign reporting. And so far, several journalists for different outlets around the world have been rejected, but I haven't seen an accompanying, like, softening of foreign reporting. So far, that tactic doesn't seem to be silencing foreign journalism.
So you're also, I'd like to talk a minute about New Voices. So you're a founding member and serve as a chair for New Voices, which mm-hmm. is a writers and artists collective that promotes the diverse work of women in China. Can you tell me a bit about that organization and the mm-hmm. work that you are doing?
Yeah, so I think I'm kind of painted quite a dark, sinister, or kind of scary picture of China so far, but the reality is that it was also a really great place to live. Beijing, like the community, was amazing in that a lot of the, you know, quote-unquote foreigners there, even if they were foreigners like me, were in Beijing not to only have a good time, but to because they were passionate about China. Mm-hmm. They cared about improving Chinese, understanding what made the country tick. So it's such a great community, and this happened really organically, New Voices, where, you know, men and women alike, people of different genders, we were noticing that as the world became more and more interested in China and was seeking out experts, seeking out people to write books, be on TV, often these people who were telling China's story to the world were not women, they weren't people of color. They were often white men, which is, you know, the case in many fields. But we felt it was particularly strange given that when we looked around us, a lot of us doing really great work were women and people of color, including men of color. So we started the New Voices Collective first as a directory of female Greater China experts. That, like, went super popular overnight. So now we have more than 500 people, experts on that list, and huge media outlets, BBC, CBC, New York Times, pretty much all the outlets I could think of have told me that they use that directory because a lot of people want to diversify the people they're speaking with. They might not have the time to build those networks, but we provide that network. And from that directory, we also branched off into events, social media groups, chapters. So now we have international chapters around the world because a lot of people follow China issues no matter where they live or they're part of the Chinese diaspora all over the world. We have really active chapters in Australia, D.C., New York, London, and Shanghai, Hong Kong. So it's been quite exciting. It's only been like a year and a half, but it's a huge community and very positive community. Every event that we've put on, it's at least a quarter of the group are men who are really supportive of celebrating women colleagues and the contributions of women in the China field.
That's great. That's awesome. And I know another woman I spoke to, who she has an organization in Ottawa, and what they do is they try to get, they have their directories around women who can speak on different issues that they try to get the press to use when they need an expert to talk about a certain subject. So I think that's really cool. And I want to ask you a question, another question then, which is more around kind of mentorship. Do you have mentors that have helped you navigate your career thus far, or really just what is mentorship to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I had mentors. In a way, I kind of sought people out that I admired, that I wanted to know, get some feedback on things I was doing, and I found that people in the industry. Often I think when people think of mentorship and menteeship, they think, I need to find the most senior person, most famous person to give me advice possible. But what I found was that actually reaching out to people a few years ahead of me on the career ladder and the number of years of experience was actually often way more helpful because they had only recently gone through what I was going through. So that was helpful. And then once I gained a bit more experience and more job opportunities, I reached out to people, or I was open to giving advice to people just starting out or a few years less experience than I had. So I think that's kind of like a more sustainable type of model of mentorship, menteeship, where you kind of give people a leg up.
Yeah, I think that's great. And so now you're the bureau chief of the Toronto Star Vancouver office. So tell me about that role and how what kind of leadership style you bring to it.
Yeah, so I was living in Beijing for 4 years, you know, very intensely. When I first started in Beijing, I had a full-time job for the German news agency, DPA, but I also freelance on the side. And then when I was with AFP, I wrote a big 100-page report on censorship for Pan America. So it was like an intense time abroad where I wanted to pack in a lot very quickly, because I knew I wanted to go back to Canada to my family is here, my partner's here. So when I was coming back to Canada, my original thinking was I would just be in like semi-retirement for a little while and take it easy a bit. But then this opportunity came up of the Toronto Star, and you don't say no to the Star. It's Canada's largest paper, and they were doing a very exciting thing where they actually nationalized. So the Toronto Star's was mainly for a long time based in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And then the parent company had papers in different places, but these different papers did not often collaborate with the headquarters. So over a year ago, the paper nationalized. So we wanted to provide a new national paper working with newsrooms across the country. So I was first hired on as deputy bureau chief and then became bureau chief. To help lead the newsroom in this expansion and going after like our mandate of ambitious stories, investigative stories and stories and that kind of tell the stories of what's happening in our patch of the world, but also contextualizing and showing readers across Canada why what's happening in Vancouver, for example, is impactful and important for the rest of the country, if not the world. And personally, what I bring to my writing here in Canada is that I look at BC as part of the Asia Pacific. So we've been able to find quite a few stories. Like my colleagues and I have kind of the same worldview where we're trying to look for linkages. So we've broken stories to do with China, Canada. We have exclusive interviews. I interviewed the former Canadian ambassador to China and, you know, tough questions, and he ended up being fired the same day.
Right.
not that a mark of good journalism is getting people fired, but I think asking good questions and knowing what to ask and knowing that foreign relations is important for daily news in Canada is something that we're trying to do in particular.
Well, you know, and I'd love to ask you a follow-up question about your interview with the ambassador. Is what was the fallout? Was there fallout from that? Like, what has your experience been after the story went out and he was fired?
Yeah, like it was interesting because a lot of people, I think people in Canada are so nice. A lot of the knee-jerk reaction was like, what did you do to that poor man? Kind of almost like blaming me. Or I think the damaging thing or the negative thing that I saw out of, I think the reactions were 95% positive. But that 5% that were negative were like, you're a young Asian woman, basically, that was a subtext. How did you get him to say these things, this experienced politician that was bad enough that he got fired? Like, you must have tricked him somehow. People actually said those things or heard them secondhand. And I think that kind of reflects what I've noticed being back home in Canada, that our stereotypes about people, women of color are quite deep. So I would, even like going around and just chatting with people on the streets, like I'm saying I'm a journalist or a star, it would take quite a while for them to even acknowledge that I was a journalist and a professional. Someone the other day was like, oh, I thought you were an accountant. But besides, I never provided evidence of being an accountant, but I think people have really, really strong stereotypes that I've found, like sexist and racist stereotypes that I find kind of a pattern here that I was kind of surprised by, because now I'm in a position of leadership and as a relatively young woman, early 30s, so I'm kind of encountering that and finding that interesting.
So that is interesting because, you're young, as a person of color and a woman. That's a very interesting kind of trifecta almost to be in of mm-hmm. of experience that you must have. Do you think, so you've been in the role, I think, has it been over a year now as bureau chief?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think needs to happen? Because I think what you're talking about is things that have been ingrained into people over centuries. Mm-hmm. How do you change that in people mm-hmm. to not have those stereotypes?
Yeah. So I think kind of like a cultural national myth we have in Canada is that we are always relatively more progressive than the Americans, basically. So people are rightfully proud of the relative peace and tolerance that our country has. But that kind of pride and happiness in our relative goodness kind of dampens criticisms and reflections on the type of work we still have to do as a broader society. And I think part of it, including the media, is that it's predominantly white. Many newsrooms do not have any people of color or women on their top leadership. So those type of unconscious biases get reflected in our institutions, even in the media. So it takes time. We need people who represent different perspectives in leadership roles. We've seen issues of race and identity become bigger issues, partly because we've seen the rise of some more racist groups and some politicians on different sides of the spectrum actually pandering to some of these harmful stereotypes. So I think it's slowly people are waking up that xenophobia, racism, even white supremacy is the real, are real forces in Canada.
Right, yeah, and I guess it's always been the, like, oh, the Canadians are the nice ones or whatever, but, mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is, but it seems almost, you know, things that are happening to the south of us and our neighbors, right, it's mm-hmm. so horrendous, the things you're hearing, but it seems that that's, like, absolutely part of Canada as well. Mm-hmm. So, I want to ask you another question then about, you mentioned that, you know, there's not many women or people of color, diverse voices at the top in you know, a lot of papers or in journalism. Specifically when you're speaking about women, because mm-hmm. It's funny because I never thought of journalism as like a male profession, a highly dominated mm-hmm. male profession. Do you know, are there a lot of women that are coming up and just not making it to those top positions mm-hmm. or are women not choosing to become journalists?
Yeah. So before I move on to that, I just want to plug some of my colleagues' work on of xenophobia, white supremacist yeah. type of political leaning. So in my office, Melanie Green does amazing work on that. and Jeremy Nuttall as well in the Chinese community. And in Alberta, Omar Mosley, Nadine Youssef, they're really tracking what's happening in Alberta, which you can imagine is really interesting because there's a lot of conservatism there. So there's a lot more space for those groups to rise up. And as for leadership, actually, we did an informal poll, just a few weeks ago, and I asked people, have you ever had a female editor or female boss? And before the Toronto Star, because the Star right now, the editor-in-chief is a woman for the first time in a while, Irene Gentle. And my boss at the Star is Angela Mullins, who is a woman. Right. And that's new for me, and that's a first for me. And that's a first for many people, actually. I think it's not as obvious because what people see, the face of media, is often the frontline reporters, people on camera. They don't see the people making the leadership managerial decisions on the top, and that's still in Canada predominantly white men. With varying openness with even recognizing this is a problem. So there's been scandals like at Post Media, Vancouver Sun, with the opinion columns that some managers have approved, including one recently, which was just straight up very racist and xenophobic. There was an op-ed that said basically Canada doesn't need to be tolerant. Canada should rethink its immigration policy and the whole, and completely rejected diversity as something good. So those kind of things sometimes go through when you have people who have blind spots about how to judge whether something is going to be harmful or not for big parts of the population. So what the Star tried to do in its hiring, at least for, on a reporter level, is to be as diverse as possible, not out of political correctness, because we recognize that Canada's diversity is not being reflected in our newsrooms, and there might be stories we're missing and perspectives we're missing.
Right, yeah, absolutely. The op-ed that you were talking about, was there repercussions to the editor?
I don't know, because it was an internal issue, and I'm not sure how it was resolved, but it did lead to a lot of reflection in other media outlets, including ours. Mm-hmm. So we, at the Star, we have formed a diversity committee, so people who are dedicated to trying to take leadership and making sure that we have high standards and that we're not doing harm to both employees and our readers by some of the decisions that are taking place day by day. And you can imagine how quickly things move. We publish hundreds of stories a day sometimes, and there's only so many editors. So it's tough, but I think outlets need to prioritize some of these questions.
I want to ask you just one final question, is kind of, if you could go back to when you started after you got your master's and have lunch with yourself, what would your conversation look like? What advice mm-hmm. would you be giving your younger self?
Yeah, I think when I started, because like I said at the beginning, it's so tough to make as a journalist. I was like professors in my undergrad, several were like trying to discourage me because they knew that it's so hard to find work. So I was also going in during kind of economic crisis globally. So I was so anxious. Like, I felt that I had to work all the time. I noticed that not just myself, a lot of young journalists had that mentality where, like, we just need to work so hard to have any chance of success. So as interns, we would be the last ones in the office, for example. Or we would take on different jobs like I did. Like, I freelance on the side. I did research jobs on the side. And I think I really burnt myself out, despite being young and having my health. One time I flew back to Canada and I literally looked green, my parents said, because I was just like not sleeping much and just working so much. So I think if I could go back, I'd be like, just calm down. You're hardworking, you have good training, and you need to take care of yourself too. And things will work out. So I think that would have made my early years in journalism more manageable if I had a little bit more faith in myself that I would be able to keep working as a journalist.
Okay, so now we're kind of at a part that we call, it's just the fast three. So it's kind of three questions that I ask you and about kind of what you're interested in, what you're reading. And we'll just get your responses, and that would be fantastic. So the first question is, what is your favorite podcast or source of information?
Well, I need to plug our New Voices podcast because we have a twice monthly podcast, completely volunteer run, which is part of our mandate of celebrating women who are doing amazing things in China creatively or in academic or media world. So I've been able to find so many interesting people just from the people we interview in the podcast that you wouldn't know are doing such amazing things, but we try to find people who aren't already always taking interviews and asking them about their work. And my co-volunteers mostly run the podcast, so it's all, everything's on our website, which also has original stories and features on what our different chapters are doing, and that's at newvoices.com, nuvoices.com. And as far as other news sources, I think, like everyone, we get it. Sometimes I feel like what's changing is that we don't go for the news outlet. We go for our favorite journalists.
Right.
So I have some favorite reporters that I often follow on social media and try to read everything they write. So that kind of what has evolved in the industry, where I can list some reporters I follow, including
awesome.
Like on China issues, right?
Sure.
I think in the U.S., so what we're trying to do is we're looking at how China and Canada are interlinked and that there's been some human rights and freedom of speech issues you see in Canada. In the U.S., my friend Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, I'm sorry if I butchered her name, she has been doing that in the U.S. So how Canada, how U.S. and China are linked up. And there's a lot of things going on. When I say China, I mean like Chinese Communist Party, the government. So she's been uncovering a lot of things there.
That's good. That's awesome. So what are you reading right now?
Let's see. I'm looking around my bookcase. I think I'm doing some research into ADHD because I do have ADHD and I'm trying to learn more about how to take advantage of my natural traits and manage the downside so that kind of like hacking your own self in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, because I find my kind of like ADD brain and I'm really interested in so many things and have so much energy has been quite good for journalism. But now I'm working on a longer piece of writing, reflecting on things going on in China. I need to like sit down and focus more. So trying to find the best tips and tricks on how to both run around and multitask and also sit down and focus on a long piece of nonfiction I'm working on.
Okay. And our last question is currently, who inspires you?
Like lots of people inspire me. If I want to talk about a Canadian, like I said, who kind of paved the path, one of what I would say people that inspired me was Jan Wong. She was a Globe and Mail journalist, and she was in China during actually the Cultural Revolution and wrote about that. And she was the Globe and Mail's first female and bureau chief in Beijing who was of Chinese descent. So I think I admire her for how strong she is in going after stories very boldly, but also for paving a way, for being a successful female Chinese-Canadian journalist in mainstream media here.
Well, Joanna, I want to thank you for taking time again to chat with me today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and it's been awesome to have this time to get to know you a bit. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for the great questions and for doing this podcast to highlight women's voices. So I think our mutual missions are quite similar.
Run It Like a Girl is hosted by Bonnie Moak. The producer is Brian Long, with technical assistance from Dan Moak, and music by the talented Brooklyn Gilichuk. On the next episode of Run It Like a Girl, Mitzi Hunter is the Member of Provincial Parliament for the Toronto riding of Scarborough-Guildwood. She served in cabinet positions within the government of Kathleen Wynne, which included the demanding portfolio of Minister of Education. Mitzi, who was born in Jamaica and grew up in Scarborough, is now running for the leadership of the Ontario Liberal Party, which will culminate at a leadership convention in March. Mitzi Hunter, on the next episode of Run It Like a Girl.